Hi, this is Aaron Eby, and this is a re-recording of a teaching I delivered yesterday on Shabbat, October 20th, 2018, here at Beth Emmanuel. So last week, once Shabbat was over, we said the weekday evening prayers as usual, and then a group of us headed outside for a monthly ritual known as Kiddush Levana. Now, some of you may have never experienced this ceremony, so let me give you a rundown of what it's like. So first, someone looks outside to verify that we can see the moon in the sky. If so, we march outside and stand in a mob outside the door like a chorus of Christmas carolers. And then we strain our eyes in the darkness to read a string of seemingly arbitrary and unrelated passages from the Siddur. A few lines from Song of Songs, a few psalms, a quote or two from some rabbis. We dance on our tiptoes, recite a bunch of things three times, including a verse that we recite backwards. Then we turn around and say Shalom Aleichem, suddenly greeting three people that we've already been hanging out with for the last 12 hours, as if we just noticed they were standing there. It's kind of a bizarre thing to do, and we do it with such tremendous dedication here at Beth Emmanuel, even though it's hard to understand. But I thought today would be a great time to figure out what is the meaning and purpose of this ritual, and even better, to learn what it can teach us about the Messiah and the final redemption. Coincidentally, after I already decided on this topic and began writing my notes, I discovered that October 20th is International Observe the Moon Night, an annual event promoted by NASA, which they describe as an invitation to celebrate the cultural and personal connections we all have with our nearest neighbor. So there are some other good reasons to talk about it today. We're in the month of Cheshvan, which is known for being the most uneventful month on the Jewish calendar. There are no holidays, so it's a good time to talk about the lunar cycle in general. And we can also see a connection to our Parsha. So this is the week we were studying Parshat Lech Lecha. And at the very trail end of last week's Parsha, at the end of Parshat Noach, we were introduced to a man named Avram. Now in Genesis, we are given very little information about the heritage of Avram and his spiritual upbringing. We do know that he was once in a place called Ur Kasdim. And then his father's family started to relocate to Canaan, but they only got as far as Haran. His father, Terach, died in Haran, and it was after this that God called Avram to go to Canaan, to Canaan. But the book of Joshua gives us a little more information. It says in Joshua 24, verses 2 to 3, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, long ago your fathers lived beyond the Euphrates. Terach, the father of Avraham and Nahor, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Avraham from beyond the river and led him through all the land of Canaan and made his offspring many. I gave him Yitzchak, Isaac." Now, this is kind of confusing if you think about it. How is it that Avram lived in this idolatrous family and then out of the blue God called him? I mean, why didn't God do the same thing for all the other idolaters? Why is it that Avram, this member of an idol-worshipping family, suddenly gets called out to serve God? There must have been something special about Avram. Here's another interesting clue. It says in Genesis 15:7 that God said to him, "I am Hashem who brought you out of Ur Kasdim to give you this land to inherit it." So that phrase, "who brought you out," in Hebrew, is Asher Hotzeiticha, and it's identical to the terminology used elsewhere to describe the Exodus from Egypt. So this wording implies that Avraham was rescued by a dramatic miracle, just as God freed the Israelites using signs and wonders, a strong hand and an outstretched arm. Kind of seems like there's a story here that the Torah is not telling us about Avram in Ur Kasdim. Well, the good news is that when there's such a story, the Midrashim are there to elaborate on it and fill in all the details for us. According to the Midrash, Avram deduced from nature that there must be a creator that transcends nature, that the sun and the moon were not gods like other people thought, but they were both merely following the orders of the true God. And this is what got him into trouble. Now, the word Ur in Ur Kasdim happens to mean heat or fire in Hebrew. So when God rescued Avram from Ur Kasdim, it wasn't just the name of the city. It was literally a fiery furnace, like the city was named after the fire. So because of his rebellion, of Avram's rebellion against the false gods, he was brought to the king of the land, whose name was Nimrod. Now, in the palace of Nimrod, they were about to worship the fire. So goes the story in the Midrash. So Avram piped up and said, wait a second. Water is more powerful than fire. Water has the power to extinguish the fire. We really ought to be worshiping the water instead. Nimrod paused and said, okay, yeah, fair enough. Let's worship the water. So they went to worship the water. Avram continued, but it is the clouds that provide the water. So why don't we worship the clouds? Nimrod conceded, oh, fine. Okay, we'll worship the clouds. But Avram went on, but wind scatters the clouds. So why not just worship the air? Nimrod said, okay, all right, we'll worship the air. But humans breathe air, so why don't we worship humans? Finally, Nimrod had enough. He said, listen, you're just stalling here. I just worship the fire, all right? And I'm going to toss you into it, and if your God is so powerful that he's more powerful than fire, then he'll save you from it. Well, he did. He tossed Avram into the fire, but miraculously, Avram emerged unscathed from the fiery furnace just as his descendants, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah did so many centuries later, as is recorded in the book of Daniel. But anyway, what's the Midrash's point? It's that Avram saw creation as revealing the Creator. So in Genesis 15, Avram complained to God that he would die childless. It says, the Torah says, that God took him outside, the Torah says, and said, look at the stars. According to the Midrash, astrology, which was the cutting edge science of Avram's day, told Avram that he was destined not to ever bear children with Sarah. But when the Torah says that God took him outside, it means that he brought him not just outside of his tent, he brought him outside of the confines of the natural world. I'm not limited by science, God says to Avram, and neither are you. So he told him to look at the stars, and the Hebrew word there used for look typically means looking down, downward. Meaning that God took Avram, so to speak, to a vantage point above and outside the universe. So there's a theoretical physicist whose name was Stephen Hawking, and he was working on writing a book, but he passed away in March of this year before his book could be finished. So his colleagues stepped in and, using material from Hawking's personal archives, managed to complete the book. And it was actually just released this week. Now, in this book, entitled Brief Answers to Big Questions, Hawking flatly declared, there is no God. No one directs the universe. In Hawking's view, the fact that the universe seems to follow orderly rules means that there's no place for God. Hawking wrote like this. I think the universe was spontaneously created out of nothing according to the laws of science. If you accept, as I do, that the laws of nature are fixed, then it doesn't take long to ask, what role is there for God? Astoundingly, Hawking is making the same observation that Avram made 4,000 years earlier. There's not a God hiding behind the cloud, tossing thunderbolts and making it rain. Nature is just following laws. On that, Avram and Hawking would agree. Yet Avram takes another step and says, but without a sovereign ruler, there would be no laws. I mean, what do you want, Mr. Hawking? If the world were chaotic and arbitrary, not following laws, then you would believe in God? Hawking says that there was no time before the Big Bang because the entire universe existed within a singularity. And, you know, time is relative to space and so matter and so on. And it makes sense. He says, so he concludes based on this, we have finally found something that doesn't have a cause because there was no time for a cause to exist in. For me, this means that there's no possibility of a creator because there is no time for a creator to have existed in. And this belies Mr. Hawking's error. He's looked all throughout creation and failed to find the creator contained within it. It would be like reading the Lord of the Rings trilogy and then claiming that the author, J.R.R. Tolkien, does not exist because the story follows a natural and logical sequence of events. There's no room for an author. Of course you can't find the author inside the story because a character cannot write the story in which he or she exists. But what you can find is the author's handiwork, as well as the author's intended message and meaning. And when you recognize that something has meaning, then there has to be someone who meant it. Hawking, in his brilliance, was so close and yet so far from understanding this. He concludes the first chapter of his book by saying, "We have this one life to appreciate the grand design of the universe, and for that, I am extremely grateful." To whom, Mr. Hawking? Grateful to whom? To nobody in particular? Psalm 19 teaches us about this. Here's my translation of Psalm 19, which I prepared for the Vine of David Siddur. It says, this is the beginning part of it, "For the choir conductor, a psalm of David. Heaven expresses the glory of God, and the sky tells of the work of his hands. Day to day flows with speech. Night to night provides perspective. There's no speaker, nor are there words. Its voice is inaudible. The line of the sky stretches across the whole earth, and its words reach the end of the world. He placed a tent within it for the sun, which is like a groom emerging from his bridal chamber, eager like a champion to run a course. Its start is at the far reaches of heaven, and its circuit leads to its end. No one is hidden from its warmth." Okay, so what is this inaudible voice that declares God's glory? In my view, these are the laws of physics that testify to their lawgiver. What's the Psalm's point in comparing the sun to an enthusiastic athlete? This is just a metaphor. Of course, David doesn't imagine that the sun is literally an athlete. His point is that it's not a god of its own with an independent will. It's merely a servant of the Creator who gave it a command, and it refuses to violate that command. Now, nature, then, especially the sky, as depicted in this psalm, reveals God's essence to us. The psalm goes on to tell us of an even greater revelation of God's nature. If you keep reading the psalm, it's talking about the Torah. The Torah, then, is a revelation of God. We encounter God each time we read it. You want to know about God? You want to see what God is like? You read the Torah. And as such, we say a blessing every day for the study of Torah. It's like saying hello. It's like greeting God when we encounter him. Now, if you've got the eyes to see, like Avram, heaven is also a revelation of God. So why don't we say a blessing when we see the sky? And the answer, according to the sages, is that we do. Now, the sun is great, but the sun is always the same. It's just a big, bright ball of fire in the sky, and you can't even really look at it without damaging your eyes. But to the Jewish people, no celestial object quite tells a better story than Earth's nearest neighbor, the moon. Now, actually, to be accurate, there is a blessing on the sun, too, but we just don't say it very often, every 28 years or so. But the moon is one that we can say on a frequent basis. And so the sages explain that it's incumbent upon Jews to formally recognize the revelation of God through creation, and to do so once a month with the renewal of the moon. So here's the statement in the Talmud regarding this. It says, Rabbi Acha Bar Chanina cites Rabbi Asi, who cites Rabbi Yochanan. So there's a chain of tradition going on here. And this is what they say. Whoever blesses the new month in its proper time, it's as if he greets the face of the Shekhinah. In other words, the divine presence. So what they're saying is God is revealed to us through the lunar cycle. So by blessing God once every time the lunar cycle repeats, you are properly acknowledging God's presence. So yes, God, we see you in creation. We recognize you. We look at the moon and say, we're on to you. We know what you're about. But you might object to this and say, well, if we're greeting God in revealing himself to us through creation, why do so only once a month? I mean, if God is beaming at us through creation constantly, maybe once a month isn't enough. The Gemara anticipates our question and continues, explains. It says, the school of Rabbi Yishmael taught, if the Jewish people merited to greet the face of their Father in heaven only once, one time every month, it would suffice for them, since in the blessing of the moon, there is an aspect of greeting the Shekhinah, the divine presence. So in other words, yes, it is enough to do so once a month with the renewal of the moon, because there is really something special about the revelation of God through the moon. So saying the blessing of the moon is really like greeting the Holy Spirit, greeting the presence of God. The sage Abaye reacts to this and said, okay, if we're really saying and greeting the presence of God when we're saying this blessing on the moon, we're greeting the King of the universe, then we ought to show proper respect by saying this blessing while standing up to say the blessing. And that actually is the practice to this day. We stand to say Kiddush Levana. So what is the wording of this blessing that they're talking about? Here's the translation in the Vine of David Siddur in progress, and it comes to us right from the Gemara out of Sanhedrin 41a in the name of Rabbi Yehuda. It goes like this. This is the first part of it. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who created the sky with his utterance and all their legion with the breath of his mouth. He gave them rules and timing so that they should not deviate from their instructions. They are glad to carry out the will of their owner, who acts in truth and whose act is truth. And the first part of this blessing seems really straightforward. I mean, God gave the heavenly bodies physical laws to follow, and they do what they're told. That is how the world works. But the blessing continues. It goes like this. He instructed the moon to renew itself as a crown of beauty for those carried in the womb, who will ultimately renew themselves like it, and glorify their maker on account of the glory of his kingdom. Blessed are you, O Lord, who renews months. Now that second part of the blessing begins to explore the question of why. Yes, we know that the phases of the moon are determined by its position relative to the sun and the earth. Yes, we know that that's how the phases of the earth exist. But why? So according to this blessing, God wanted the moon to renew itself in cycles to tell the story of his people, who also go through cycles of diminishment and growth, cycles of exile and redemption. So when do we say this blessing? So one might think that maybe we should do so every Rosh Chodesh. But, you know, like every Rosh Chodesh, every new month when the moon appears. But we specifically actually don't do it right on Rosh Chodesh. Ashkenazim wait at least 3 days after Rosh Chodesh. Sephardim wait 7 days. The latest we should say it, there's a window of opportunity, so the latest we say it is halfway through the month. Now, why would we not want to say it during the second half of the lunar cycle? Because what's the moon doing at that point? It's waning. It's diminishing. So we wait until to say that blessing until we can see with our eyes that the moon's brightness is substantially increasing and telling us the story of redemption. And this concept is actually alluded to right in the Gospels. Some of you may have heard this teaching. It's one of the classic teachings of Pastor Lancaster. But turn to the genealogy of Yeshua in Matthew chapter 1. Look over that genealogy, which I think actually would be a really interesting addition to the liturgy of Kiddush Levana, if you ask me. Note that Matthew begins this genealogy with Avraham. It doesn't begin with Adam. Why does he begin with Avraham? And then at the end of it, in verse 17, he explains, "Thus all the generations from Avraham to David were 14 generations. And from David to the exile of Babel were 14 generations. And from the exile of Babel to the Mashiach were 14 generations." Now, what's Matthew's point in noting this pattern? In which, if we're being honest, everybody knows this is something that's well known, especially in the apologetic circles, that those 14 generations is a little bit forced. Now, the fact that it's forced doesn't undercut its credibility, but what it does is it underscores that Matthew is trying very hard to tell us something here. He's trying really hard to make a point with these numbers. What is his point? So as noted over 100 years ago by Messianic Jewish pioneer Rabbi Yechiel Tzvi Lichtenstein, the Evan Sohar, with these cycles of 14 generations, Matthew is tapping into a long-standing Jewish tradition. It comes down to us through the Midrash in Shemot Rabbah 15. This is the deal. Israel is compared to the phases of the moon. So just as the moon fills up for 15 days and then reduces for 15 days, so Israel, for 15 generations, ascended ever higher from Avraham to Solomon, to King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech. So after that, those 15 generations from Avraham to Shlomo, their status began to diminish because Shlomo's heart turned astray. So the status diminished until the destruction of the first temple and the exile to Babylon. So in other words, so the world was once full of darkness. Then Avraham came on the scene and it was like a sliver of light appeared in the world. And God told Avraham, Lech Lecha, go. And that light, the light of God's revelation in the world, grew and grew with every successive generation until it reached its peak in the days of King David and Solomon. But what happened next? Solomon's heart turned astray, and the light began to diminish in each generation until the exile, mimicking then the phases of the moon. But Matthew picks up the tradition from here. He says, it's not over. The pattern is still going. Ever since the return from exile, the moon has begun to fill itself again. And now, here we are in the generation of Yeshua. Matthew points out that we're on the brink of the 14th generation. Once again, the generation of redemption. And you can hear how excited he is about that fact. How it must have just really inspired him and the other disciples to know that. When we recite Kiddush Levana, we say these four statements. We look at the moon and we say, blessed is your molder, blessed is your maker, blessed is your owner, blessed is your creator. And why do we say those things? It doesn't actually really make sense unless you're saying it in Hebrew. The word for your molder, blessed is your molder in Hebrew, is Baruch Yotzrech. So Yotzrech is molder. That what letter does Yotzrech begin with? It begins with the letter Yod. Your maker in Hebrew, blessed is your maker, is Baruch Osech. Oseh is maker, and that begins with the letter Ayin. So then we say Baruch Konech, blessed is your owner. So Konech, owner, your owner, begins with the letter Kuf. And the last thing we say is your blessed is your creator, Baruch Borech. Borech starts with Beit. So the four letters then, we're forming an acronym. Yotzrech, Osech, Konech, Borech, Yod, Ayin, Kuf, Beit spells Yaakov, Jacob. And so what we're doing was we're saying to the moon, we see what you symbolize. We know it. We get the parable. You're talking about the generations of Israel, the generations of Jacob. We're on to you, moon. We know what you're about. And so each month as we watch the moon glowing brighter and brighter in the sky, God is telling us a parable of Israel's redemption if we have the spiritual vision to see it. And we long for the day when the moon, so to speak, will become full and then never wane again. And we wonder, is this the month where that will happen? I mean, according to Jewish tradition, this is how things were in the very beginning. At first, when the moon is created, it says God created the two great luminaries, not as if they weren't distinguished from another. And then later it says the greater one and the lesser one, as if the moon at first and the sun were equals in the sky. But and then it was a part of the corruption of our world that the moon became diminished, and now we're in this seemingly endless cycle of light and dark and day and night and full moon and hidden moon. Now, we're not talking on a scientific level here. We're talking on a spiritual level. But this is the reality we live in now, where there's these endless cycles of light and dark. But in the Messianic era, you read what the prophets say about light in the Messianic era. According to the tradition, the light of the moon will be like the light of the sun and like the light of the first day of creation when God said, let there be light, even before there was a sun or a moon or any stars. And now we know, now that we understand this, these two key things about Kiddush Levana, there's two things. One is that the purpose of Kiddush Levana is to greet the face of God as revealed to us through creation. And the second thing that we understand about Kiddush Levana is that when we do so, we are confronted with the good news that redemption is coming, which, by the way, is another way to say the gospel. And then once we know those two things, all the other strange customs that we do on Kiddush Levana make sense. For example, we have a better sense of what it is that Rabbi Yehuda meant when he taught us the blessing. He said he instructed the moon to renew itself as a crown of beauty for those carried in the womb who will ultimately renew themselves like it and glorify their maker on account of the kevod malchuto, the glory of his kingdom. Now, I don't want that phrase to be lost on you. On account of the glory of his kingdom, kevod malchuto. That's the phrase that we say quietly after the Shema, but in temple times they used to shout it upon hearing the explicit name of God. This is a key phrase describing the manifestation of God's sovereignty in the world. That's the Messianic era where the prophet says, in that day the Lord will be one and his name will be one. The Lord will be king over all the earth. This is Kavod Malchuto. That's why at Kiddush Levana we also sing, David Melech Yisrael Chai Vekayam, David, King of Israel, lives and endures, because we can see the moon is on its way to full brightness, to the full moon, to the number 14. The generations are on their way to David, which is another name for King Messiah himself. And that's also why we recite this passage out of Song of Songs. It says, look, the voice of my lover. Look, he comes, leaping over the mountains, jumping over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. See him standing behind our wall, watching through the window, peering through the lattice. Now, they picked up a commentary on the Siddur, the Dover Shalom, explains why we recite this passage from Song of Songs when we're doing Kiddush Levana. And this is what he says. Saying these verses in Kiddush Levana is in a sense recited in Yalkut. He says, the voice of my lover is King Messiah. And when he comes, he will say to Israel, this is the month you are redeemed. Kind of copying Moshe Rabbeinu, who said, you know, this month is the beginning of months, and we begin to count the months from Nisan. So when Messiah comes, he will say to Israel, this is the month you are redeemed. And leaping over the mountains describes how at times he's revealed to them and then at times concealed from them, just as the moon is sometimes revealed and sometimes concealed. So I imagine watching somebody running over the mountains very quickly or riding a horse over the mountains in the distance, and you could see them appear at the peak of the mountain, and they go into the valley and they hide, and they come back over a nearer mountain, and then they hide, and then they come over a nearer mountain, but they keep on hiding. So that's describing how Messiah appears, disappears, appears, disappears, and how the moon portrays for us that dance, as it sometimes is revealed and sometimes concealed from us. You don't need a minion for Kiddush Levana, but we try to. I mean, the custom is that we gather as many people as possible. Why? Well, because we're the formal welcoming committee for the presence of God. The more people we can gather, the more honor. This is a principle based on Proverbs 14:28, which says, "In a multitude of people is the glory of a king." And that principle applies in a lot of different situations. But just imagine if you're having a welcome home party for someone and it's underattended. That's kind of embarrassing. But for God, the presence of God, we're welcoming him and recognizing him in creation. We want to have as many people join us as possible. And it doesn't have to be on Saturday night after Shabbat, but that is the custom. Why? Well, because it's ideal that we're remaining in the afterglow of Shabbat, when we still have that smell of Shabbat on our clothes. And also, if you think about it, out of all the times of the week, there's no time of the week more packed with the potential of redemption than the departure of Shabbat, that with Havdalah and everything else that's going on. What happens if it happens to be cloudy on Saturday night? Then, well, you try for Sunday night or your Monday night. But you got to remember to put on some decent clothes, because you're greeting the face of God. But we don't do Kiddush Levana. I mean, we think, okay, well, if Shabbat is such a great time, why don't we do it on Friday night? I think it might be possible to do it as a last resort, but we preferably don't do it on Friday night. Why not? Well, it's not like it's Malacha exactly. It's not the prohibited creative activities on Shabbat. We're not petitioning God with mundane weekly woes and pleas for mercy exactly. That's not what we're doing. So what is it that's wrong? What's wrong with Kiddush Levana on Shabbat? Well, there's one thing that we're supposed to do at Kiddush Levana that's not appropriate for Shabbat. And to be honest, it's not really something we do very well when we do Kiddush Levana at Beth Emmanuel. I think there's some room for improvement in this particular regard. So you see, Kiddush Levana, as we know, is deeply connected to King David. He's generation number 14. His name, spelled Dalit Vav Dalit, even has a numerical value of 14. Dalit is 4, Vav 6, Dalit 4. And King David was known, among many other things, for his dancing. Yeah, there's a certain kind of dancing that's forbidden on Shabbat. Not all dancing is forbidden, just a certain kind. And this kind of dancing that's forbidden on Shabbat is kind that we might call Davidic dancing. Now, what do I mean by Davidic dancing? I'm not talking about Israeli folk dances. That's not really Davidic dancing. Davidic dancing is the kind of dancing that's filled with such joy that you set aside your personal sense of dignity for the sake of the honor of Hashem. So if you're the kind of person that says, dancing's not really my thing, I'm not good at it, I'm not that kind of person, I'm a more reserved person, or I'm the CEO of a Fortune 500 company or something like that, perfect, great. Now is the time for you to get Davidic. Because on Kiddush Levana, it's such a serious requirement that there's this kind of dancing where you set aside your own dignity the way David did as the king of Israel, that the sages actually postpone that ceremony until after Shabbat. They don't let you say it on Shabbat because they want there to be that kind of dancing. So why do we suddenly turn around and greet one another and say, Shalom Aleichem, and then the other person's supposed to say, Aleichem Shalom. Actually, this is really good to know. If you're ever, in any time of the week, you're greeted by someone who says, Shalom Aleichem, peace upon you, the correct response is to say the same thing back in reverse, and you say, Aleichem Shalom, upon you peace, basically. So, Shalom Aleichem, Aleichem Shalom. So that's the etiquette. So, at Kiddush Levana, we stand there shaking people's hands. Shalom Aleichem, Aleichem Shalom. Shalom Aleichem, Aleichem Shalom. Shalom Aleichem, Aleichem Shalom. We're shaking people's hands. But stop for a moment and listen to what we're saying. Shalom Aleichem. Peace be upon you. Shalom be upon you. And that is the defining characteristic of the Messianic era, of the kingdom of heaven. Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov explains in the Book of Our Heritage, which is a great book series. I highly recommend it. He explains the greeting serves as a reminder that God will inform Israel of her impending salvation in peace, as the verse says, out of Isaiah 52, Ma navu al heharim ragle mevaser mashmiya shalom mevaser tov mashmiya yeshua omer letzion malach elohayich. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes shalom, who publishes peace, who brings good news of happiness, who publishes Yeshua, salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. That's why we're shaking people's hands and saying shalom aleichem. What could we possibly do to dramatize and rehearse the Messianic era better than to have brothers reach out to one another with expressions of shalom and to have that shalom returned to us? So think about it. What did our master do when he appeared to his disciples after he rose from the dead? Take a look at Luke chapter 24, verse 35. So then they told what had happened to them on the road, that's the road to Emmaus, and how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. And when they were talking about these things, Yeshua himself stood among them and said to them, Shalom Aleichem. That's what the Messiah said. And the disciples were so caught off guard by this visit out of nowhere that they forgot to respond, Aleichem Shalom. And maybe that's the real purpose of our greeting one another at Kiddush Levana. Maybe we're practicing so that when we hear Yeshua say to us, Shalom Aleichem, with our own ears, we will instinctively know how to respond, Aleichem Shalom. And this is the message of the renewal of the moon and how we greet the face of God as he reveals himself to us in creation. So here's the choice I want to set before you today. When you observe that nature follows laws, will you be like someone who stands on the surface of the earth, looks up at the stars, and says, well, there's no room for God because nature is just following laws? Or are you going to zoom out a little bit, gain a new vantage point like Abraham, let God take you outside, and look down at the stars and see that they are performing without hesitation the will of their owner and creator, and it would behoove us to do the same in anticipation of the final redemption.